Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams 4th of July sale and get 30% off paints and stains June 27th through July 7th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News.
You know what we actually have to do is figure out a way to record your conversations that you're having live on Scoop before I join the program, because that's where all the good stuff happens. For those of you who are not a Scoop insider or choosing not to join us live, we get it. We understand. We love you anyways, but we do have an insider community that gets together and joins the broadcast live on Mondays, and we get to interact. You get your questions answered live. It's awesome. And I feel like we're actually really getting to know each other. And there are certain days that we just let it all hang out. Which is what's happening. I think it's because it's before a holiday. It's a holiday week. By the way, holiday weeks, we should just take the whole week off. Because when you have Friday off, then you're really taking Thursday off. I mean, let's just take the whole week off. So I just want to congratulate you. If you're showing up here live, thank you for this. Because we have a really big serving of news today that is going to get you prepped and ready for the rest of the week, I promise. But also, I think all of us are a little bit on vacation mode. I was just running. I was a little bit late. So a few quick business items before I get to the nitty gritty. That's a technical term of what's going on with the news. A few business items. Well, first of all, number one, thank you for being here. I see Jeremy jumping online. Jeremy sometimes is there's all sorts of dudes, by the way, that join Smarter News that are followers of Smarter News. But Jeremy, by the way, gave a great piece of advice to all of us about a portable battery. I'll make sure that's in the show notes. Thank you, Jeremy, for that. Coming with a couple tips for us as well, smarter tips. But there was a very rich, robust conversation on the many stages of a woman's life that was happening on our chat today. You know, all the way from birth and beyond. And Jeremy just threw his hat in the middle of things right there, and is brave and is not deterred. And so thank you, Jeremy. And thank you to all of you. Barbara, Emily, congratulations. Mandy, great to see you. Jan, Sherry, Cheryl, it's great to see all of you. So thank you so much for that. I was racing from an interview that I had with a historian at Mount Vernon. And let me tell you why, because you're going to hear this interview a little bit later on this week, fingers crossed. I always say fingers crossed because even when you record it, you're like, let's just make sure that it happened, that there's no gremlins in the system, that it's saved, that all the things are happening. The reason why I was talking to them is in part inspired by you and something that I shared just recently about what was happening in the colonies, the American colonies in 1775. We're going to be so forward-looking to the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and really what we describe as the founding of America, which was in 1776, next year. So we have all these 250-year anniversaries being set up. But as we were preparing for our shows over the last couple of weeks, I'm realizing that there was a lot that happened in 1775 that's being ignored. And perhaps we should have moved some of our celebrations to this year, because what happened 250 years ago at this time, on this day that we're speaking, for example, really set us up for the Declaration of Independence, which, as our historian today described, was more or less an afterthought and a way to announce to the world what was happening in America. But the fight for independence was already happening at this moment 250 years ago. So we do have that interview coming up this week. Final quick, again, sort of housekeeping item. We are changing over our podcast platform to something called Red Circle. And Red Circle is a way for us to work with actual people, which is always a plus. You know, you could automate a lot of things, and we're going to automate some things through Red Circle. So if you're an insider, I'm just going to ask for your patience just for about the next week or so. If you're an insider for Smarter News, you're going to get your own podcast link so you can listen to all of our different content. If you like podcasts, if you prefer that, completely ad-free. For those of you who that's not your jam, totally understand. Red Circle is going to help us place some appropriate ads where it makes sense in our programming. So that's going to be new and it's going to be different, but we need it to be part of a larger podcasting platform that will also help us grow. And we think this might be one way to do that. So we're going to try it out for the next 6 months or so, see how it works. We have some control over ads. You know, we can say, for example, what was it? There was a category, this will make you laugh. These are the sort of things I didn't realize I was going to have to confront as a media executive that I am, as an editor in chief. So as part of the way to sort of filter the sort of ads that you may see, because we don't want any politics, right? We don't want things that are overly political or, you know, overly controversial. You know, if we want to do like a little ad here or there, fine, but I've protected this space for so long. I'm not willing to just give that up. But so you had to look at a category. And you had to say, okay, this category is okay, this category is not okay. And there's like 400 of them. One of them had to do with like supernatural. I was like, supernatural, like poltergeists, like ghost hunters. And I mean, I'm interested in that sometimes. Does that work? Like in the middle of this broadcast, if someone ran an ad for ghost hunting, like, maybe that would be fine. I don't know. These are some of the things that we're going to have to work out together. So welcome to a new adventure. And this is what it's about, building a solution in news. I want to have these conversations with you because I think that's one of the big mistakes in the major media organizations is you don't know who's behind it and what are their decisions that they're making and why they're making those decisions. And this all plays into this feeling of an overly partisan press or a press that has this kind of this dark corner that you don't know exactly what their intentions are. No, we're just here building a nonpartisan news platform that hopefully informs you, makes you feel good about consuming news again, that you can do with your whole family, you know what's going on in the world, and that doesn't totally take all of your time. I want to take less of your time. I want you to get more bang for your buck. And so that's what we try to do through Scoop, which is our foundational broadcast today. So let's jump into it. Here's the theme for today, which doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. But it's important because it's what's missing from some of the news coverage right now is an understanding of why the news feels so muddled. And it has to do with the way that we're looking at the Big Beautiful Bill Act in the Senate. It has to do with the way that we're looking at different parts of that bill that are coming up for debate, either publicly or through social media, whether it's public land sales or Medicaid. It has to do with how we're looking at the Supreme Court rulings. It's this question of what is a story that's about procedure and what's a story that's about substance. And these things are sort of linked together because what we're going to be talking about in our stories today is not only what's being discussed or debated, but how it's being discussed and debated and how that's impacting the information that's coming across your screen. So we're going to have to pull these things apart. And it's sort of like a ball of yarn that once you pull one string, another knot emerges. You pull another knot emerges. And it's a difficult, muddy news cycle. So if you're feeling that way, like, wait, what in the world is happening? It's in part because it's changing so fast, but the procedure is impacting the substance. And so we're going to work through that together. Let me show you this. I just want to show you something good. As we get started today, it's a picture of an American flag over Chimney Rock in North Carolina, a famous spot. For those of you in North Carolina, you probably can tell us a lot about this. I was first introduced to Chimney Rock through our coverage of Hurricane Helene that went through that area last fall and was so destructive. And so Chimney Rock, the state park, is now reopened officially, and they're waving the American flag. If you go to their Instagram account, by the way, it's beautiful, so it's worth checking out, a different place in the country if you haven't seen it. You can see all these amazing images from the past about how Chimney Rock came to be and this amazing view from Chimney Rock of this incredible valley. And I saw this American flag and this announcement of the reopening and thought, it's such a signal of American resilience. Despite the different storms that we go through, look at what we're able to eventually achieve and come out stronger, hopefully, than we were before. And what a great metaphor for this week, thinking about the Declaration of Independence and the different political storms and actual storms that we've been through together as a country. And that American flag is such a symbol of something that's good, that's about freedom, and is about resilience. And so I want us to keep that in mind as we're working through some of these issues that are pretty heavy to work through. I see Barbara on the live chat. North Carolina, right, Barbara? You're coming to us from that. And Barbara says, we got to be in the western part of the state next week and hope to talk to the hubs into making time for a hike. Okay, Barbara, here's your point. You're going to play this clip for him and you're going to say, babe, if you love me, you can't let me down because we need to send photos to Smarter News of us at the top of Chimney Rock. I understand it's actually not that easy, though, of a hike. Part of the reason I was looking at this, though, and it's going to tie in again to some of our topics, is this area was private land. It was owned by somebody that bought it from speculators in the area and eventually had the dream of opening it to the public. But it was a long path, no pun intended, to that. And this idea of who owns the land in America and who has rights to it is one that's been really important going back to the very beginning about who has the right over their property and who has the right over one's life to make decisions for one's life. I mean, this really comes back to the Declaration of Independence. So where should we go first? We could go to the Supreme Court first, or we could go to the Big Beautiful Bill. I think I'm leaning towards going to the Big Beautiful Bill because that's in front of us and it's changing really fast. And it has a little tie into public land. Now, Chimney Rock, as my understanding, is a state park. It's not federal land. And we're going to talk a little bit about federal land, but I'm going to leave this beautiful picture up while we're talking. So let's just big picture here what's happening with this package. We're calling it a package because it's not legislation per se. Legislation would have to go through a different procedure. Legislation would have to survive a filibuster, which is this level of votes in the Senate that would require a certain bipartisanship to move legislation forward. You need at least 60 votes. We know in the Senate, as well as the House, we're almost evenly divided. But remember what I say about that word divided. Yes, we are almost evenly divided in both of these governing bodies. We're either evenly divided or balanced. It depends on what word you want to use. If I say divided, we have this idea of us clashing. If I say balanced, I wonder what reflection of the American public we're seeing in our lawmakers, that we have such balance in both of these bodies, which is making moving legislation really difficult. Because if you wanted to just put something forward along party lines and say, hey, Republicans, vote for this, or hey, Democrats, vote for this, it would have to be really, really good to get everyone in your family to vote yes. And that's what Republicans are confronting with this package. They confronted this in the House of Representatives, where they could only lose just a few votes. Otherwise, it would not pass, but it did. Now it's in the Senate, and Republicans are in the same situation again, where they can lose 3 votes. They already know they're going to lose 2 on this package so far, but they could lose 3 or more than 3, and then the package dies. I'm calling this a package because it's a way of passing through Congress you can see I'm struggling for words because you have to be really careful. These are different items that relate to the budget and budget policy. And if it relates to the budget, it can be called reconciliation. And reconciliation allows you to pass this sort of package of different efforts, different policies, I want to be careful with that because it's not law, through Congress without getting those extra votes. But not everything that you think should be in the package will end up being there because the Senate has something called a parliamentarian. And the parliamentarian is going to go through this big document and look at all these different things. And I'm just imagining her with a red pen. I don't know if it's red or green or purple. Either way, she's looking through it and saying, whatever you just proposed, that can't be part of this reconciliation package because that's actually legislation. You're going to need to vote on that. Okay, let me see this. Nope. You made this proposal about public land sales? Okay, Yeah, that's going to have to be legislation. Oh, you had this proposal about Medicaid? This portion about Medicaid can stay. This other part about Medicaid cannot, because that doesn't qualify as reconciliation. That has to be in a legislative effort. That's out. So as you're seeing these stories come again across your screen, there's actually something happening in the background that is almost giving those stories permission to develop or tabling them. And so the way that this is, for example, just share a little personal story. I've had a handful of different parents reach out to me, just personal friends, where their children rely on Medicaid and they're worried about what they're seeing in the news. But the reality, and they're just wondering, they're like, hey, Jenna, what's going on with this? Like, I don't understand. This is really important to me. And it's hard because even at this moment that I'm broadcasting to you, which is Monday midday, there's a question of what's going to end up in the final package. And so certain things are being debated or even proposed, certain amendments, and whether or not these things can stay if the language is appropriate. And by the way, not to add just one more thing, but if the parliamentarian says, okay, that this part, let's say about Medicaid, can't stay the way it's written, you can resubmit it written in a different way. It may change the policy though, and then you're going to have to figure out if you have the votes. So this is like an ongoing evolving story, and how this can impact real people is hard to quantify at this moment. Because even if this package gets through the Senate, which is what Republicans are trying to do this week, if there are changes, which it looks like there are, it will have to go back to the House. And then the House will have to decide if they're going to approve it. So this is very much in motion, and it makes it difficult to cover. And I was talking to one of my colleagues here at Smart News, and I said, I feel like it's a cop-out. Like, I'm not digging deep enough into Medicaid and this particular issue. The hard thing is I can't, because the minute that we do it, it can change again. And so this is where you ask the question, well, wait a minute, isn't that happening for lawmakers too? Do they actually understand what they're voting on? Do they have enough time? And this is the dance that's being done in the Senate at this very moment. So the procedure here is as much the story as the substance. Yes, the substance is what could affect us. There's a question about tax cuts and Medicaid and healthcare and all sorts of things that could be in this package, money for the border. But the reconciliation process is determining what's actually here. And again, if it relates specifically to a budget, a budgetary effort, it can stay. If it seems to cross the line into a real legislative policy change, then the parliamentarian will flag that and will kick it out. And so that's one of the things that we saw this weekend with public land sales and Senator Mike Lee, which I'll get to in a moment. So let me just play a little bit though, before I get to the public land bit, I want to talk to you a little bit about Medicaid, because this is where we are seeing a lot of voices. And I want you just to have a variety of voices in your head as we're wondering what's actually going to end up in the final package and what will senators actually vote on. So let me play for you first. This is Scott Bessent. He's being challenged on Bloomberg TV this morning. He's talking about, you're going to hear this conversation about healthcare and Medicaid. He's the Secretary of the Treasury. He's been really fundamental to getting this package together. Remember, the Trump administration, the White House, wants to set the table. They're still newly in office. They want these tweaks to the budget and where money is going, because they want to set the table for future policy. This is what they say. This is the beginning. This is not the end. So yes, it doesn't have the spending cuts that maybe we'd like to see, but that's going to come later. This is what we need to do now. Obviously, their critics disagree with this, even their critics within their own party, and say, this is not the way to do things. This package is too big. There's too much spending, and there's too many cuts in the wrong places. So let's take a listen to Scott Bessent.
House level of cuts to Medicaid prevail, or the Senate level, and which one will the president support?
We'll see. My sense is, and again, I take exception to cuts. We are actually bending the curve further out. We are getting able-bodied people back to work, and the most needy will have greater benefits.
Well, the main question, too, is the benefits that are being cut. What do you tell the nearly 12 million people that are on the brink of losing access to Medicaid?
Well, no, again, that's not right. 1.4 million are illegal aliens, then a huge percent of that are the able-bodied working people who will need to go back to work. So we're going to have a work requirement, and you know, we'll go from there. We're just going back to the levels pre-COVID.
So that's the argument coming from the Secretary of Treasury. Let me play some sound from Senator Warner. He's from Virginia. He's a powerful voice in the Senate, often works with bipartisan efforts, not afraid to do that. I want you to hear what he says about what's being proposed regarding Medicaid and what he thinks the second and third order effects may be of this.
16 million Americans off of health care. You know, Medicaid cuts, these numbers, they're not my numbers. They're all independent sources. And what the thing that I don't think people have realized, people say, well, Medicaid, I'm not poor. I maybe buy my health insurance through the marketplace. Your rates will go up $800 or $900 a month. And that will trickle through the whole rest of the healthcare market, because if you suddenly take people out of the system, they show up at the emergency room in uncompensated care, the only way those costs get passed on is higher health insurance to all of us who have traditional coverage.
All of us who have traditional covers, that he says. So he's saying, you know, if we take a certain amount of people, we change Medicaid, because Medicaid is such a big program through the U.S. government. It's affecting the entire healthcare industry. And there's going to have to be an adjustment period no matter what happens to this. And this is going to be one of the negatives. Senator Tillis of North Carolina announced just over the last 24 hours or so that he's not going to seek re-election. He's getting pressure from the Trump administration to get on board with this bill. He does not agree with this part about Medicaid cuts in the way that they are currently in the package. And so I want you to hear from him as well, because it shows there's diversity even amongst the party about the path forward.
Last time I saw a promise broken around health care, with respect to my friends on the other side of the aisle, it's when somebody said, if you like your health care, you can keep it. If you like your doctor, you can keep it. We found out that wasn't true. Now, Republicans are about to make a mistake on health care and betraying a promise. It is inescapable that this bill in its current form will betray the very promise that Donald J. Trump made in the Oval Office or in the cabinet room when I was there with finance, where he said, we can go after waste, fraud, and abuse on any programs. I'm telling the president that you have been misinformed. You supporting the Senate mark will hurt people who are eligible and qualified for Medicaid.
So here we go. So you can see there's a lot of questions about how the cookie is going to crumble here. I just saw a comment come in from Lindsay. I want to pull that up because I thought it was important. Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us today. She said she joined because following it very closely, the Big Beautiful Bill, which by the way is the official title. You know, I've hesitated using that because it was the way that the administration was referring to the bill, but then it became the official title of the bill. So here we are. So what Lindsay was saying is she's been following it very closely, personal connection to a grant being eliminated, and I get more confused with each speech as new numbers and calculations come from both parties. Lindsay, you're not alone with this, and I'm sorry it's not easier. I wish it was easier and I could point to something for clarity. Like, this is a great resource. This is going to help you. This is very hard right now, and we don't know exactly, again, what senators will end up voting upon at this moment. When they're talking about different estimates, they're pulling usually from the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan group that scores legislation or scores packages or proposals that are put through Congress, saying, okay, if this happens, if you do this, and the economy grows this much, then this is going to be the effect. This is how they're getting the numbers with how many trillions of dollars a bill could cost us, or what's going to be the effect of a tax cut. You know, all of these different variables. The administration has been pushing back on the Congressional Budget Office because they're saying that their estimates for economic growth are too low, and therefore it makes the bill look, or this package, see, I'm struggling with the language, I apologize, the package look less attractive. But it does give the Congressional Budget Office will issue a report. And this is where journalists, different lawmakers can look and scour the report and say, well, this is what the Congressional Budget Office says. It is also still an estimate. It is it's well-respected, nonpartisan, but still an estimate. And we also have to be crystal clear about this, because we're in a time when there's a lot of chaos. We're always looking for certainty. Well, if we do this, it's going to cost us this much money. well, if we do this and there's a pandemic and the war in the Middle East gets bigger and then there's something happens with oil prices, then A may not equal B. And so we just need to know that there's not a lot of certainty, but there is an idea, there is an estimate, there is a forecast. So Lindsay, keep us posted on that because it is, I can imagine. I mean, this is real life, right? Medicaid, grants, this is real life for real people. And I never want to forget that as we're covering the news. I just want to offer a little bit of insight into why this is so confusing. And I feel like we're not slowing down enough to explain this. The reconciliation process can be used by both parties. Republicans aren't the only ones to use it. And in how sweeping this package is, it just has a lot of different variables and elements in it. So one of those elements was the public land sale. Did you guys see this? I got some questions about this. The public land sale was proposed by Senator Mike Lee. And let me just take a big step back. Over the years, there has been proposals in the past about selling public land or gathering the resources from public land. The Trump administration has been very clear overall that they believe that America should be resourced, meaning that we should pull the minerals, we should pull the oil, we should use the things that are within our territory to make us stronger in the world. Obviously, critics disagree with that because there is some concern about environmental efforts. There's concern about where and how this takes place. And this is the first time I've seen this story sort of come up on a national stage in such a way. So Senator Mike Lee was in part behind this proposal of having this part of the package included a sale of public lands. And his thinking initially, let me go back because there's a few different I want to just read to you where it initially was. And part of this story in general was that there was a big backlash on social media. And one of the questions I had for you is I wonder in a different time period if this story would have gotten the same attention without social media. Because there was a lot of people that maybe were not necessarily politically aligned. You know, you may have an environmentalist who doesn't like to hunt. A vegan environmentalist. I'm from San Francisco. I'm going to stereotype. A vegan environmentalist from San Francisco. Gotta love them. And then we're going to get an elk hunter from Colorado. Well, let's Idaho, Montana. Let's just maybe they don't necessarily fall in the same political silos. But on this issue, they're united, and this gathered a lot of steam. So the initial proposal was to allow the sale of 2.2 million to 3.3 millions of acres managed by the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service. That would happen across 11 states, Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, Oregon, Utah, Washington, and Wyoming. This would take place over the next 5 years. And the bill would mandate, this was a key part of it, that 11 states sell a small percentage of all Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Forest Service lands, which would total up to a maximum of 1.5% in some cases. So sell between 0.5% to 0.75% of what land was out there. So it was a very small percentage. However, it was how the land was going to be used and where the land was. So if the land, and this is either in the first proposal and the second proposal that came through, would have to be within 5 miles of a residential or like a commercial area, an area of commerce. Now, what that was and what that looked like is sort of TBD, depends on your state, right? There would have to be some sort of area where building a home essentially 5 miles away would make sense. And so the land would have to be used for the development of housing or to address associated community needs. And this would be defined by secretaries of the Interior and Agriculture. So again, not necessarily the states. Senator Mike Lee, for a long time, has felt that the government just owns too much land out west. Now, he's the senator from Utah, which is interesting. Utah is a beautiful state, lots of open land there. And he says that selling off this small percentage of public land would actually help erase some of the nation's housing crisis, which isn't just about the number of homes, but about affordability. So this is how he's linking these things together. However, there's a lot of critique to this because this public land has been used for all sorts of things, whether it's hunting or hiking or camping or the beauty of the state. It's also part of the industry for local areas. I was watching a report out of Idaho where a small town, their whole town is surrounded by public land. And one of the main outfitters in the area depends on that public land for their fishing and canoeing and for their business. If it doesn't, if it's not all public land, if it becomes housing, well, where do people work? And will the tourism stay the same? And then you create a secondary issue. This is what some of the critics would say. There was also a key part in this legislation, which is it would also make an additional 250 million acres. There was also a key part in this provision. It's not legislation. That would also make an additional 250 million acres eligible for sale with limited exception. So this alarmed people. And there was a swell of social media activity I noticed over the last week talking about this has to be brought out, taken out of this package. This is not what some of the supporters of President Trump voted for. They were very alarmed by this. One of the things that happened is the initial proposal was then scaled back to fewer lands, fewer amount of acres, from 600,000 to 1.2 million acres. Again, with these would be acreage within a 5-mile radius of some sort of commercial or residential or commerce area. But that didn't fly. And according to Senator Mike Lee, he issued a statement. He kind of described what happened. So I want to go ahead and read that to you in just a moment as I pull it up here so I can see it clearly as well. Looking at a couple different things. So this is what he said. Over the past several weeks, we've spent a lot of time listening to members of the community, local leaders, and stakeholders across the country. While there has been a tremendous amount of misinformation and in some cases outright lies about my bill, many people brought forward sincere concerns. Because of the strict constraints, the budget reconciliation process, I was unable to secure clear, enforceable safeguards to guarantee that these lands would be sold only to American families, not to China, not to BlackRock. That's a big private equity group, and not to any foreign interests. So he's saying himself, the way that this procedure is taking place, the procedure is impacting the substance of what I'm trying to put forward. I'm trying to put forward something that I believe in, but I can't put in the appropriate safeguards. And without knowing for sure, the parliamentarian probably looked at this and said, well, that language, that's too much like legislation. You're going to need to fix that. You're going to have to move that out or fix the language. And if you can't put the safeguards in that he's saying that he wants, then he's going to pull it out altogether. He says this, for that reason, I've made the decision to withdraw the federal land sales provision from the bill. He goes on there, though, and I think this is really critical that you don't lose sight in this if this is an important issue to you. I continue to believe the federal government owns far too much land. Land it is mismanaging and in many cases ruining for the next generation. Under Democratic presidents, massive swaths of the West are being locked away from the people who live there with no meaningful recourse. That has real consequences for those in Utah, from raising taxes for schools and funding local search and rescue operations to being able to build homes and sustain rural communities. President Trump promised to put underutilized federal land to work for American families. And I look forward to helping him achieve that in a way that respects the legacy of our public lands and reflects the values of the people who use them the most. I'm grateful to everyone who took the time to offer thoughtful feedback. Your voices help strengthen the bill, and they will continue to shape the path forward. Again, oof, the bill, the bill, the bill, the bill, the bill, the bill. If it's a bill, if it's legislation, probably needs to go through a different procedure. So hopefully that adds a little bit of clarity. Again, the substance of what he was trying to do is affected by the procedure. He has to abandon it. Also, there was this swell of social media critique that could be impacting the final passage of the bill for Republicans. So they decided not to pursue it. But did you see, he's not giving up on this. He believes this is what should be done. And so we should watch this topic for future stories. It's not over yet, is what I got from that statement. And perhaps that deserves a little bit more nuanced conversation. Who can buy it? What does it look like? How can it be developed? Are we talking about tract homes in the middle of a beautiful hiking area that's nearby a quaint rural town that's been passed through generations upon generations of locals? Like, what does that actually look like? How do you create jobs in areas like that if it is rural? And what does that look like? So there's a lot of questions. I can understand that. And we'll see where it goes from here. So something to watch. One of the fascinating parts about this big, beautiful bill is it's been very eye-opening about what is a priority to this administration. And what I would say is key to watch for is as we're getting closer to this thinking that there will be a vote on it, and we don't really know when that could happen, is what actually is championed and remains in. This idea, this tax cut. So the tax cut that's in the bill right now was extended through the Biden administration, but it had an expiration. So my understanding of the process here was that it was a tax cut proposed by the first Trump administration. Some of those tax cuts were continued through the Biden administration, and they're going to expire. So it's not asking for new tax cuts. It's trying to keep the current ones in place. That's really, really critical to the Trump administration, because if they expire, as they describe themselves, it would be one of the largest tax increases that we've seen in recent times. They don't want that. So could there be a scenario where this monster package gets way, way more lean in order to pass through the Senate, pass through the House again, and to be called a win by the Trump administration during their first year in office? A lot of moving parts there. So we're just going to have to wait and see. And even as we're talking, there are new amendments or changes or additions to the package that are being introduced in the Senate. So we'll see what happens. The president wanted this on his desk by July 4th, which is Friday. Is there a possibility for that? There is a possibility. We don't know what's possible at this very moment. It's a possibility. There's also a real likelihood that we could see this talked about for the rest of summer or not see it really pursued in earnest until the beginning of September. But remember, we have also a funding bill that's going to need to be passed in September to keep the government from shutting down. That's separate from this. And so Congress would be putting a lot on their plate going into the fall. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. Any questions about that? As I look on our live chat, anything else that we can add to this? Michelle was asking a little bit about the giant tax hike that keeps getting mentioned. Haven't seen an explanation on it anywhere. So that's what that tax hike would be. Michelle's an expiration of some of these tax cuts that have been ongoing that, you know, depending on who you are, you may realize that they came into place or maybe doesn't affect you as directly. The Trump administration believes that these tax cuts are really important in order to keep the economy on a trajectory that they believe they can put it on for continued growth. So we'll see what happens next. All right, let's move to this is a great question, Katie, just real quick. How does what's in this bill impact what will need to be in the budget in the fall? That's a really great question because there are separate things. One is for the immediate funding of the government. You know, this is the money that we're going to use to run the government over the next year. And then these are more, I don't want to say they're ideas or concepts, but it's this, we're going to put this extra money towards the border, for example. How would that affect then how much money I think needs to go to the border in the fall is a question. They're related, but not interconnected in a straight line is my understanding. This is more of a concept that's this packages or like the concepts. This is how we want to set up Medicaid. This is how we're going to set up things in the future. This is going to be the guardrails for these things. And then, what Congress is doing is more of like, I don't want to say a household budget, but a little bit like that. You know, these, so like in your household, you have, these are how we want to approach healthcare in our household. This is how much money we think we're going to put towards vacation. This is what we're thinking about this project. But then we have the essentials that we have to fund. And it feels a little bit like that. I don't know if that's totally accurate, but that's how I'm positioning it in my head to kind of understand the differences. So, and hopefully that helps. I wish I had more confidence on all of this. Every single time we go through a budgetary effort, legislation, the way legislation kind of dances its way through Congress, I have to review the process because it's not something that any of us do except if we're elected to public office. So it's a little bit difficult. Thank you for your grace in that. All right, let's talk a little bit about Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with the Supreme Court. I just want to touch base on two of these decisions that came down. Two of them we've talked about previously, and both of them are big stories that could have a lot of consequence, because anytime the Supreme Court issues a ruling, it's the highest court in the land, and it's about the U.S. Constitution. And it's very easy to get locked into what the story is at the time and not think about the broader implications of the rule. Again, it's the procedure versus the substance. So let me take these two cases in front of you. We had one that was about birthright citizenship, but not directly. I'll get to that in a moment. It's referred to as that, so you're going to see it as that, but I'm going to talk about that in a second. And then the second case was out of Maryland. We talked quite a bit about this, about a public school system where you had several parents that came forward and challenged the school board and challenged the school when there was different curriculum that was introduced that they felt pushed them as parents to address issues that were antithetical or conflicting with their religious beliefs, because some of these books were subjects related to LGBTQ communities or different storylines. So let's tackle the one about birthright citizenship first, and then we'll tackle the one about schools. So when President Trump came into office on January 20th, he issued an executive order, and the executive order was about birthright citizenship, saying that the way that we have been providing citizenship to anyone born in this country is not the way that was initially intended by the 14th Amendment, that you shouldn't just be able to automatically get citizenship. Now, that's the way that the 14th Amendment has been interpreted for many, many decades. So this is a direct challenge. The executive order is placed and immediately it's legally challenged in federal courts. So you have an attorneys general across several states saying, wait a minute, this is unconstitutional. The president can't do this, can't do it through executive order. No, this can't happen. And a federal court, hearing these cases, hearing this challenge, issued an injunction, which is basically like an emergency stay, which says, okay, it's the executive order was issued, but it's not in effect nationwide. It can't go into effect. What the president and his administration did is they didn't challenge on the substance of the case, which is the birthright citizenship. They're challenging the process, which is, wait a minute, a federal court does not have the power to nationwide prevent an executive order going into effect. Like, how does the federal court have that power over the presidency, who, according to their argument, is making this decision on behalf of the national security and the vibrance of the American people? A federal court should not be able to do that. And this is what the Supreme Court was hearing. It wasn't about whether or not birthright citizenship is going to stay. That is likely going to be a challenge that reaches the Supreme Court because of this executive order. What they were purely looking at right here was whether or not the federal court can issue a nationwide injunction, essentially halting this executive order. Now, let me just preface this, though. The executive order, in that it was immediately legally challenged, was not going into effect. The administration could say that it was, but how it was going to be applied was totally confusing, because it wasn't a law. In order for the Constitution to be changed, it has to go through Congress. You need ratification from states. Like, there was no total understanding about how this executive order would be reacted to in the states, because it's not codified into law. It's not federal law. How do you enforce something you don't know exactly how it's supposed to be enforced? There's a lot of confusion on it. So the injunction was an attempt for legal clarity, right? Which is, okay, what I mean by that is if this is immediately the executive order is being challenged in court, and the judge is like, okay, as this challenge is taking place, there's a nationwide injunction, this doesn't go into effect. Okay, we're all on the same page. We're good. Everyone's good. We're not doing anything with this. You got to get this through court. There's a challenge, a pretty good challenge. Nothing's happening. Basically, the nationwide injunction just made it very clear nothing's happening on this executive order. When you don't have a nationwide injunction, there's more confusion of how an executive order could be applied or not applied, because again, it's not law. And that's one of the big downfalls of executive action of any kind, especially executive orders like this, is that yes, it's coming from the president, but the president is not king. We have Congress for laws. And so this is how we get into these legal challenges that we're in right now. So what the Supreme Court essentially said here in this decision, though, is very, very important. They said, yeah, a federal court can't issue a nationwide injunction. But the impact of that is sort of a question mark, meaning the executive order overall wasn't going into effect because the legal challenge was ongoing. And because we don't really know how every state or every municipality would handle this executive order, it probably, you know, wasn't going into effect. But even as I'm talking about this now, it's the probably maybes, it doesn't apparently, it's not codified. There's a lot of legal confusion without a nationwide injunction. But what the Supreme Court said is, yeah, the federal courts can't do that. They can't just stop an executive order in its tracks and say, everyone, everywhere, this is not happening. These challenges, legal challenges, have to play out through the courts. And if a district judge or federal judge is ruling a certain way, that doesn't mean that they get to rule that way for the entire country. And in fact, Amy Coney Barrett had something, she had some very important comments on this, and I'm going to pull that up just to read to you. As I want to play a little bit of sound from the White House as well. Here's what Amy Coney Barrett said. She said, some say that the universal injunction gives the judiciary a powerful tool to check the executive branch. But federal courts do not exercise general oversight of the executive branch. They resolve cases and controversies consistent with the authority Congress has given them. When a court concludes that the executive branch has acted unlawfully, the answer is not for the court to exceed its power to do so. But then the question comes in through that. So she's saying, like, listen, like the court doesn't get to do that. Like that, by the way, that's really for the Supreme Court to decide when it's unconstitutional or not. But the question that, or what she's not doing there is saying who does. So when she says, when a court concludes that the executive branch has acted unlawfully, the answer is not for the court to exceed its power to. Okay, but then who is the check on the executive branch? What does that actually look like? And what does the court have the power to do? The dissent was written by Justice Sotomayor, and she said this, by stripping all federal courts, including itself, of that power, the court, speaking of the Supreme Court, kneecaps the judiciary's authority to stop the executive from enforcing even the most unconstitutional policies. So she's saying there's a real risk here that preventing federal courts from issuing these nationwide injunctions cause this lack of clarity that I'm talking about that doesn't appropriately check executive power. If an executive really wants to enforce the order and, let's say, uses federal authorities to do so, then what checks that while these legal challenges are taking place in different areas? Here's how the White House responded. I want you to just hear some of what they handled on Friday in kind of a wide-ranging press conference that started with this announcement, which they're saying is a huge victory for the administration.
And the power of the lower court judges to stop your agenda. Do you see this as a full green light for your agenda going forward?
Well, you'd have to really speak to the lawyers about that. But this is really also a decision based on common sense. It didn't work the other way. It was a disaster where somebody from a certain location in a very liberal state or a liberal judge or a liberal group of judges could tie up a whole country for years because their decision would sometimes take years to overturn. And we have to act quickly when it comes to illegal immigration. We have murderers, killers, we have drug dealers, we have what they've allowed to come into our country should never be forgotten. It should never be forgotten what they've done to our country. And we have to be able to act very quickly, and we're going to do that.
Under birthright citizenship, if this is implemented, who would be tasked with actually vetting citizenship? And how, like, would this be a situation where you have nurses and doctors checking for citizenship of parents? Or
this is all pending litigation. It's going to be decided in October by the Supreme Court, and we'll discuss that after the litigation.
Okay, let me stop there. She's saying, that's Pam Bondi, the Attorney General. She says that the court's going to take this up in October. We don't know if the court's going to take up this case in October. The challenge to this executive order is working its way through the federal courts, and it is likely going to wind up in front of the Supreme Court because it's a constitutional question. Whether or not that happens in October or November or January, like, we don't really know the timing of this. That's when the Supreme Court returns to sessions and hearing cases, and so that's her belief that this will take place. But some of those scenarios of, like, how would this even be applied is really a question for down the road when we see whether or not how this case, in what form this case winds up before the Supreme Court. So right now, I saw a question from Jenny B to say, I understood it to mean that each case has to go to court. Some could be class action. Is that incorrect? So this, what we're seeing now are these different challenges, Jenny, go through federal court. And yes, that the, what the Supreme Court more or less said is that, yes, if in the particular areas of the jurisdictions of these courts, they can issue an injunction. But to say it nationwide from one seat or from, you know, a finite court is not possible. So it allows these cases to kind of continue, and then we'll see which one matures to the point that it winds up before the Supreme Court, where it will likely be a question of whether or not how did the founders, or how do we want to currently apply the 14th Amendment to modern day citizenship. So the administration has an argument about how history should be applied here, but this is what the Supreme Court does, sorts through, you know, do you believe in the way that the law was written at the time and how it applies now, or do you believe how it's supposed to evolve through time and how it's meant to be applied in modern times? It's very interesting. It's a very interesting process. So this is what we're in the middle of. And I think that you have to consider like the flip side. So let's say a Democrat president comes into office and says, my executive order is that everybody that's born in the United States gets citizenship. But I also think it's believed to mean that both sets of parents get citizenship. I'm making this up, you know? So the executive order is like, okay, so wait a minute, how does the federal government fall in line with that? Like, who's issuing citizenship? And maybe the state of Texas is like, I'm not doing that because we have, that would change, you know, who's a citizen in our state. And so now I'm challenging it in court, and you can see how the confusion can continue. But this is part of the process, the judiciary process, is that these cases have to work their way through the court system. And what changes now is that nationwide injunction or pause that would add that extra layer of like, this isn't going to be applied right now because it's working its way through the court system. In the meantime, as cases are working their way through the court system, often they're not enforced or previous laws are kept because there's no system to enforce a new action without it being law. Hopefully that makes sense. I know it's a little confusing. Okay, real quick here, I want to catch you up on this case that we talked quite a lot about in Maryland. And this is the case which has a very interesting multiple sides. It was a school district in Maryland wanting to introduce some new curriculum, some new books to tackle different subjects with students from kindergarten, basically up to middle school. And what was really key to this case, and I shared a couple of these books with you, what was really key to this case is that although these topics that were tackled in these books included those with LGBTQ content, the parents that were challenging the use of this curriculum were not asking the school to ban the books. They were not asking the school not to use the books. They were just asking if they could have a heads up when the books were being used in the classroom so they can opt out. What happened in the first year of this is that a lot of parents opted out. This is one of the largest school districts in the country, one of the most religiously diverse school districts in the country. And what the schools found is that they were having a hard time managing those that opted out because so many parents were opting out of the lessons that attached to this book. The parents say, again, we don't want to limit anyone's ability to use the books. We just aren't ready because of our personal beliefs and our freedom for our religion that we do not want to tackle these particular topics in this particular way with our kids. And by the way, we're also concerned about like them being ostracized too in the school, because if they're going to opt out, there was all sorts of questions about the opting out, but it wasn't about these books should not be available to students or shouldn't be used by the teachers. It was just that the parents wanted the right to have some say in what their kids were seeing in school. Now, the slippery slope to that from critics is, okay, what about evolution? What about lessons about dinosaurs? What about lessons about like stars or like anything that has to do with looking at, a topic that could have a religious viewpoint that we commonly teach when it comes to science. You know, so does that mean if parents are allowed to universally opt out of this lesson, what else can they opt out of? And then are we having like two different lessons about evolution? You know, there was a question about the slippery slope there, but a very rich kind of debate. And we talked a lot about that. I should link that in our show notes, their previous, because I read you from one of the books, a very rich debate of like what's appropriate, what's not, but also these parents were very, again, very, very specific. So that added another layer. When we've heard over the years about book bans, for example, and what's allowed in school libraries, this is not that. This was just the parents saying, I'm not sure about this particular lesson. So what happened is the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the parents. And for the first time ever, I've never seen this before, I wanted to show this to you. Their Supreme Court decision actually, let me add it to the screen, included photocopies, color photocopies of the different books, and sort of this explanation of why the Supreme Court felt that the parent should have the right to opt out of this particular lesson. Let me go ahead and read that to you. Alito, Justice Alito, wrote the decision that favored the parents here. By the way, one of the key things about the parents I want to mention, because again, I think it's very easy to stereotype, because how, you know, we're just, our brains are automatically going to go there sometimes. You think, okay, well, these parents must be, they're Christians, right? They're just Christians. They don't want to talk about LGBTQ. Well, the parent group that actually challenged initially was even more diverse than the group that ended up before the Supreme Court, which was families representing a Muslim family, a Catholic family, and Ukrainian Orthodox family, just for what it's worth. Okay, so let me just read this for you. Justice Alito said this: government schools, like all government institutions, may not place unconstitutional burdens on religious exercise. The board's introduction of the LGBTQ+ inclusive storybooks, along with its decision to withhold opt-outs, places an unconstitutional burden on the parents' rights to free exercise of religion. So this is what, and Justice Alito goes on to say this: in absence of an injunction, the parents will continue to be put to a choice. So in absence of an injunction, you know, pausing this policy, the parents will continue to be put to a choice, either risk their child's exposure to burdensome instruction or pay substantial sums for alternative educational services. As we have explained, that choice unconstitutionally burdens the parents' religious exercise. Because the parents were saying, well, we have a right to public school, and we don't want to pay for private school. We love our public school. We want to be here. We want to be around a lot of different people. This is this particular lesson that we have an issue with. Now, the dissent was also written by Justice Sotomayor, and she says this: today's ruling threatens the very essence of public education. The court, in effect, constitutionalizes a parental veto power over curricular choices long left to the democratic process and local administrators. What she's saying is, listen, there is a process for this. It's called a school board, and the community elects a school board. And so this, they don't want this, like elect a different school board, but it's not for us to step in here. That decision gets our free exercise precedent and strikes at the core premise of public schools, that children may come together to learn not the teachings of a particular faith, but a range of concepts and views that reflect our entire society. Exposure to new ideas has always been a vital part of that project until now. So she's saying this decision is going to hurt public schools, and it's going to be a problem for society because these children are not getting the variety of the community that surrounds them. For right now, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the parents being able to opt out. So again, this isn't a case about whether or not the books can be used as part of curriculum. That's not what the Supreme Court is ruling on. For now, the books can be used. And in fact, the school district did pull a couple of the books out of rotation because of some concerns about the content that were voiced by parents. So we'll see. This might be the first of many cases that are like this that even bring up this case about parental rights in a public school system and what the Supreme Court is willing to step into and consider when thinking about what sort of curriculum is available in our free speech and our freedom of religion, which is codified under the Constitution. So Melissa, I see you saying, I work at a public elementary school library in North Dakota. This is a huge concern for me. I'm curious about that. Tell us more about that, Melissa. What's your concern? Let's see. And Jenny said, yes, they were allowed to opt out to begin with, and then the district changed its mind. That's the part that seems so frustrating to the parents. Exactly. The parents were like totally cool. They weren't having an issue with it, but the district was having an issue with the amount of parents opting out. in some cases, it was emptying the classroom, you know? So it was a lot of kids. It was, that's how it was portrayed anyways, that it was a lot of kids that were leaving the classroom, not just one or two. It was a lot. And so this was affecting the lessons, and the school was like, hey, we can't do this. Sorry, guys, you can't opt out. Like, this is ridiculous. We're having to have like two different teachers. And so this is where the parents got concerned. So let's see. Natalia, I know you were reading the decision. She said, I read the decision. The fact that I thought was most interesting was the workshops that the school district had for the teachers. Tell us more about that, Natalia. I didn't get all the way through the decision, admittedly. The big, beautiful bill is tormenting all of us in so many different ways, including the sort of hours. So the hours in the day. Sherry says, growing up in the 70s and 80s, my parents always had a say in what the schools taught. They may not always get their wish, but they were allowed to make their voice known. Yes. So here we are again at this question about local school power and also the Constitution. So the local school district has some power, but how that intersects with your constitutional rights is an entirely different question. So, okay. We covered a lot of ground today. I know it was a longer pod than normal, but I wanted to make sure you had most of what you needed to get into the week ahead. Just as far as court and cultural news, I do think it's worth mentioning the case against Sean Combs, otherwise known as P. Diddy, is expected to go to the jury, which so we could actually see a verdict in that particular highly watched trial. Maybe even this week before the holiday, we'll see. We'll get an idea. If it goes to the jury, we'll have an idea within 24, 48 hours as we normally do, like how this is all going. So that's something else to watch for. Debbie and Dwayne, I see you guys also putting there, thank you for this, prayers for the firefighters and their families. Prayers for Britt Blair, for your husband as a veteran and a firefighter. Many thanks for his service. Thank you for that, Debbie. I appreciate it. That is talking about a story out of Idaho where we're still gathering information, but it looks like as what law enforcement is describing as a total ambush of firefighters. Someone setting a fire on purpose to get emergency responders there and then opening fire on them. We don't have much more details at this time. Just an awful situation. Two firefighters dead. Another one was in the hospital when we started recording this. And obviously just a really dark story with some questions about what is this all about? Who is this? And we always have to ask the question. We think of it at times as a local story. We always have to ask the question, is there terrorism involved? What are the different angles? There's any myriad of different options still on the table. And unfortunately, and it'll take a little time to get through some of that. So apologize for not having more for you now, but we don't have a lot of information at this time. So Melissa said this just because she was the one that's working in North Dakota, right? Melissa, we have had many books that have been challenged by a group, Moms of Liberty. We have had to challenge the way we do things to make sure we are legally protected. Yes, Melissa, would love to hear more about that, by the way. You know, it's very interesting. I've reached out to the Library Association. Side note, so Melissa, maybe we should talk because this idea of banned books, I wanted to get a lot more clarity on. In some cases, the banned books are referring to books actually being removed from the library. In other cases, it's referring to books that have to be moved to, let's say, young adult or an adult section or a different shelf. Growing up in San Francisco, again, a very progressive city, I went to the public library all the time on Clement Street, by the way, in San Francisco, near where I live. Beautiful building. I'm just imagining it right now. I love that place. Oh, you walk in, you smell the pages, right? The books, you smell them. You could check out a record. You used to check out Michael Jackson. You know, I was like, this was awesome. The library is such a great place. Who doesn't love a library? Okay. We love libraries. My mom still goes to that library. So it's, I can still imagine the card. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going down memory lane, but there were some young adult books like Judy Blume, for example, who touched on topics that were a little bit, you know, older preteen topics. Those books would be on a higher shelf. And in some cases, in the kids section, you would have to have your parent there to check them out. So that was my reality growing up. So what exactly does banned mean? Does it mean they're out forever? Or does it mean they're having to be moved in some way? And it may depend on the library. So that's why I've always asked for clarity on that. I've never really gotten a great response. And Melissa, maybe you can help me with that. Because I think that's important. I hear banned, I'm all fired up, you know, like, is books being burned in the streets? Like I'm ready to go. you know, even if I don't, you know, even if those are books are not the ones that I'm choosing, you know, I'm like ready to fight. So we have to be really careful with our language. I want to know for sure, like, do we mean banned or do we need banned or we need upper shelf, lower shelf? Like, what are we? I want it very specific because this is important. It's very important. And so, yes, just so you know, I'm on that beat. Okay. All right, guys. Hopefully you have a great Independence Day holiday. Check out our interview when it comes up. I hope you enjoy that. I really enjoyed this conversation about what was it like in 1775, 250 years ago. When you hear this interview, listen to what the historian is talking about, because 250 years ago wasn't that long ago. And some of the things that we're struggling in the news stories today, including procedure, substance, and what does it mean for different people in different regions with different perspectives, were the same issues that were being tackled in 250 years ago in 1775. So it reminds us of our link to history and how remarkable America truly is. It truly, truly is. The fact that we were able to pull this whole thing off is just unbelievable and against really all odds. So it's ours to continue the story however we see fit. And that comes with an incredible privilege and incredible power. And sometimes that can be a little scary as we watch how messy it can be. But it was messy at the beginning. So there's nothing new here. It's just a little different style. Procedure and substance, something to think about. All right, guys, have a great holiday week. And we'll be back with more on smarternews.com. Have a great day. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
We all know that owning a small business means you wear many hats, but sometimes you really need an extra pair of hands. Upwork is how good companies find great and trusted freelance talent. With more than 2 decades of experience, with the simple and ambitious goal of pioneering a better way of working, companies at every stage turn to Upwork to get things done and find more flexibility in staffing key projects and initiatives. They access a global marketplace filled with top talent in IT, web dev, marketing, and more. Posting a job on Upwork is easy. With no cost to join, you can register, browse freelancer profiles, and get help drafting a job post or even book a consultation. From there, you connect with freelancers that get you and can easily hire them and take your business to the next level. Visit Upwork.com right now and post your job for free. That's Upwork.com to post your job for free and connect with top talent ready to help your business grow. That's UPWORK.com, Upwork.com.